Welcome to episode 8 of the Frontal Harvest podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education.
We didn't have one.
And Hubble.
Hubble. That sounds good. I'm Patrick.
And I'm Kelly. And together, we are the hosts of the Frontal Harvest podcast.
So let's get started. It is April 26th, yep. Sunday, and the plan is to put out the podcast today.
Right.
We're a little bit late because Kelly has been sick with bronchitis, and right. So we might have some audio issues.
We're going to work on it.
We're going to work through it and see what happens. Administratively, that's about all we have. Still working with the old microphone setup. We'll see in the future. Maybe we can upgrade that, but for now. So, blog entries. I guess I should do mine first.
Yes. And
because we decided that was the right order. Except there's a little problem. I don't remember what I did.
Do you want me to start with mine?
No, I got it right here. So, quick, what did I do? It was about volunteering at the school. And it was the Raspberry Pi setup. Oh, I remember what it was. Okay, we are really kind of desperate for time right now. So, yeah, so I guess... Well, first, what happened? This was the second time that we had a Saturday session at school.
Right.
And because of all your snow days and the makerspace ran for part of that time. So I volunteered.
Which was wonderful.
Yeah. And we were setting up the Raspberry Pis. And I guess... There was one thing in particular that hit me that I found surprising about how the kids were acting.
Oh.
And it's simply that when you work with software and especially with hardware, there's a cycle that once you get some experience, you go through where you just try something and it doesn't work and you look up on the internet, you know, you search for error messages you got or things that might have gone wrong, and then you make a change to your setup, and then you go back and go to the internet and do some more searching. And it's a cycle that if you're not used to it, it can be frustrating very early on, and it just doesn't seem like you're getting anywhere. But once you have some experience, it just becomes more natural. And not all the kids, but some of the kids seem to just have an innate understanding of this. And I mean, that's the impression. Innate is a bad word.
Yeah. They've had experience doing that.
I guess what I meant to say is an intuitive understanding of that's how you go about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be from experience where they were actually taught, right? Mm-hmm. Like the parents go through this and they've gone through stuff with their parents or teachers, or it might be just personal experience because they grew up where computers were already at that stage, even before they could understand anything.
Access to information was ready.
And just being around computers, right? Like when we were growing up, there was no such thing as computers.
No.
So, you know, the first time I had my fingers on a computer, I think I must have been in high school.
Ninth grade.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I thought that was really interesting because they're only in eighth grade. And I would expect that to not be a reaction to just seemingly impossible problems.
Yeah.
And later age.
Right. So what Patrick was noticing was a few of my students would have a computer open to the raspberrypi.org page, mm-hmm. where they help you set up, in this case, they're setting up a camera. Yeah, and so he would go back and forth between what he was supposed to do and then what, you know, and then he would do it on the Raspberry Pi, yeah. and then go back to looking up kind of the next step.
That was Max.
Mm-hmm.
That was Max. But there were other kids doing other things. Mm-hmm. Max was the only one working on the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the end, that was a failure, but it was a success in the sense that we tried many things, and now we know certain things to that, you know.
Yeah.
It's like every failure is something else you've tried, and you can move on, right?
Right.
And you're narrowing down different possibilities.
And some other students were using Scratch, very yeah. early programming, and they were looking it up on one computer and then transferring
right.
insights they got onto their program that they were making.
Yeah, some of the students were just, they'd achieve something and they were just playing around, and that's just totally fine, and that's awesome. Other students were actually working on some pretty serious problems, and I couldn't tell exactly what they were doing because I was busy with right. the other stuff. But I could tell they were going through this process of trying to figure something out and then looking up,
mm-hmm.
Trying to find a solution, and just not being fazed by the fact that it didn't work.
Right. Where
it's like, okay, so that's not it.
Right. And moving on and
yeah.
and just really digging down, which is really cool to see.
So that was about it.
Okay. Well, mine, I have to say, what intrigued me most about this article on microbe diversity in remote peoples was the fact that they're remote people in the Amazon forest. And in this case, they were looking at a group, a village group called the Yanomami people. And this group has only newly been found. They were doing aerial images and they found this new village up here where they had not seen one before.
Do you know if this is the same people that they think migrated eastward?
Yeah.
Being displaced by loggers and other things?
Right. And I think it might be.
Yeah,
they have very little contact with outside. Uh-huh. They're very isolated people. And that whole idea of this very isolated people in a very connected globe today really, yeah. it just sets my brain to imagine, you know, what it must be like for them to live and what they must think of people seeing them interact with them and just coming from very different backgrounds.
I don't know if it's the same people, but Brazil has a really interesting way mm-hmm. of handling the indigenous people, giving them, and if they don't want contact, then, you know, that's fine and stuff. And the way I understand it, these people showed up. Well, I don't know if it's the same, but mm-hmm. last year some people showed mm-hmm. up in the Western Amazon in Brazil and actually initiated contact with Western people.
Yeah.
And then immediately they put together a team and went in because you're afraid of violence breaking
right,
out.
Right. So. And this, I think this is the same group.
It sounds like they've gone very far already, you know, in terms of helping out these people. And
well, they've really limited contact.
Okay.
So they
so
haven't.
They're still very limited.
They're still very limited contact. They've been very careful not to directly locate where these people are so that they are not inundated with people coming to visit them and try to make contact. They've done, in the contact they've had with them, they have been allowed to get samples, like tissue samples, mouth swabs, and fecal samples from 34 of these individuals. And then they looked at the microbial DNA, and it was pretty cool because what they thought they would find is very different DNA than what we have, like no antibiotic resistant, but they found that they actually had antibiotic resistant. They had a lot more diversity in their the microbes that they carry around with them.
So, you know, this is the second report that I've come across. I think I've told you about a report just recently, maybe within the last couple of months, about a group in Peru, also a remote tribe, not secluded totally, but a lot more than these people, I think. And they also had extremely high diversity of microbes
and
in their gut.
Yeah, and so they're thinking this has all kinds of health benefits.
Right, because the ones from Peru had much lower rates of things like colitis and irritable bowel syndrome.
And diabetes. Like
that, or inflammatory bowel
syndrome. Did they talk about diabetes at all?
I don't remember.
So you only have 34 individuals, so I don't know how they can, you know, make a kind of call like that. But they did mention diabetes. And they said that one of the bacteria, which is pretty cool, that they could, they noted would be beneficial for kidney stones and breaking down kidney stones. So that's kind of neat that they even carry a bacteria that would combat kidney stones.
That's really interesting. So, but, I mean, I always thought that this would have to be in the urinary bladder, which I thought would have been sterile.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Interesting. Maybe not.
There's a lot of mystery here. Like, you know, I read the article going, wow, this is kind of neat. And it was not, it was an article review of it, of actual research. It was not the research paper. But just interesting stuff that, you know, of course they have more, parasites that they carry with them, but they don't carry the ill effects from the parasites. They're just living on them. And, so it was just interesting to see that, you know, our diets and it being more of a uniform diet as people become more global, that our food sources have narrowed over time and our microbial, you know, microbes that we carry around with us are also limited.
So the whole antibiotic resistance genes, that's bizarre.
It is.
Because if they are really removed, it's like, you know, some, I mean, these things you would expect would have shown up in the West a lot faster if they were so prevalent everywhere.
Well, they were thinking that it had maybe an evolutionary link, that we've always carried them.
Yeah.
It just takes that trigger of using an antibiotic to cause us to become resistant, or to create antibiotic resistant bacteria. And so I thought it was an interesting thing that it was only the trigger that was necessary. We've always carried antibiotic resistant bacteria.
So, but I guess what I would like to know is precisely what is the antibiotic resistance spread of genes that they have compared to, on average, it sounds like they're saying they have higher diversity of microbes. Okay, fine. I totally get that. And that even makes sense. But it sounds like they might be saying that there's a higher diversity of antibiotic resistance genes than we do.
I did not get that from the article. Okay. I got that they were present, but that they were not any more than other people,
because that would explain
that live in modern society.
Yeah, but that would, if that was true, that would explain why they have these resistant genes and we don't see resistance show up right away from a drug. It takes some time, you know.
Anyway,
interesting.
And I just thought it was interesting that they convinced this group that's very isolated, semi-nomadic hunter gathers, to give them samples, and what they must have thought when they're giving the samples, like, okay, here you go. And so I just
the
thought
the dialogue would be fascinating if you're an anthropologist.
Right. And again, they've really tried to keep them as isolated as possible so that it's not the invasion of the modern people, which I appreciate. I think that's a really good call. So,
did you want to do some of your topics?
Okay. I did a lot of microbiology stuff this time. I was so distracted at the beginning. I read about, I don't know, how many different articles.
I remember.
And I finally focused in on this nomadic people because they, you know, that's always fascinated me how...
I don't see any articles on being ADD.
I know, but I was definitely all of them. So I read this other article on the Chinese paper on embryo engineering, and it talks about it splitting the scientific community.
Wait a second. So this is like a publication from Chinese researchers?
This is, it's actually, they published their paper, and they recently published it the 18th of April in Protein and Cell. It was submitted to Nature and Science, but it was not published by either of those journals.
So what's the Chinese part about? Is it just Chinese researchers?
These are Chinese researchers.
Okay.
And they were able to use CRISPR in an embryo.
What the whole controversy was about.
Yeah,
and the rumors that someone had actually... So they use CRISPR on human embryos.
And apparently, because I don't do anything with human embryos, these are a certain class of human embryos. So these are not normal human embryos.
Gotcha.
Okay. And I'm not sure of... if I find the distinction, I'll mention it. So this is...
So did it say, like... Nature and Science both rejected, right?
Yep.
Was it? It's not because of the quality of the science. It was like ethically.
Ethically, they chose not to. Well, let me read specifically what they said because it was not. Okay, so it was. Because of ethical concerns.
Yeah.
That's what they list.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to overstep. I wasn't sure if they had something
else. I mean, you can definitely decide not to publish something because you're worried about there not being enough of dialogue without saying anything about whether the people should have done it or not. I mean, I'm not... So, do you know exactly what they did?
So, what they did is they went in and they took 54 embryos, and they only got 4 to carry a desired genetic change.
Right.
And each of these embryos were mosaic, meaning that they were not all the changes that they intended for the cell did not take place.
Right.
They only had some...
CRISPR-Cas9 got introduced to some cells, but not others.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And when I read further down, one of the researchers said, well, the findings...
That's not unusual, I don't think.
So it's like what you were saying. Their findings were not that surprising with the CRISPR technique that they were using.
And do you know what they were trying to, like, were they trying to introduce a brand new gene or destroy a gene, or were these embryos that started out as being, like, having a disease, genetic disease they were trying to fix?
So I did not find that, what they were doing. I apologize.
Well, no, I mean, we've been rushing to get this in
and
everything, so... Maybe we can come back to it. I mean, CRISPR-Cas9 is definitely going to be with us for a while now.
So, hold it. So they did not use the new CRISPR-Cas9
system.
They used an older CRISPR system.
Ah.
And that's why they said their findings were not that surprising because they didn't even use the up-to-date
the newest system.
Yeah. But besides that, one of the researchers makes a point that, you know, what they found was not really newsworthy other than the attention that they're getting for it being done on a human embryo.
Which is newsworthy.
Which
because
is
you're
newsworthy.
Fooling around with the germline.
And in case you didn't hear when I said, you know, our researcher said this was not newsworthy,
right.
Patrick went on to say, well, this is because this is being done on a human germline. And really, that's the controversy. It's like, you know, we can wait for this. We can wait for the, you know, to really have a good discussion about the ethics and to come to terms with what would be acceptable practice and what would not. And this has not been done to this point, so this research should not be done at this point.
So I think we'll do a bit more. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll do some of my topics, but I think we're going to be cutting it pretty short because we're definitely having a lot of problems with you, like having coughing and stuff from the bronchitis. But I see you have technique to cut disease, mutation. Is that all part of the same thing?
Oh, so that was cool. So this is a group that's using a DNA targeting technique known as TALEN. And basically, what they're doing is they're going into eggs and embryos, and they're removing these mitochondria that are damaged, and the same mitochondria that could go on to cause disease.
Uh-huh.
Because there's certain mitochondria diseases that can happen if you have these damaged mitochondria. And so what they did is they set up this technique, and it went in and chopped up all the DNA or all the mitochondria that are unwanted and left the good mitochondria.
Interesting.
And they did this for the first time in mice, and they ended up with healthy offspring.
Uh-huh.
So healthy, the embryos developed into healthy pups, they call them, which I thought was fun, the mouse pups. And then these mice also went on to produce healthy pups.
So when they destroy a bunch of mitochondria, does that mean that the mitochondria that are left over start to reproduce? I guess it must, because there must be a signal in their cells.
Because, you know, you think of the muscles. Don't you have a change in your mitochondria depending on the amount of use?
On exercise, yeah.
Yeah, so I assume it would.
So that must be a long-term effect. Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting. And it's just one of those new things that may have an effect on disease transmission.
Don't overtax your voice. Did you want to go on about anything more? You've had oil and gas and Hubble. Do you want to move on maybe?
Okay, just maybe Hubble.
Just maybe Hubble.
Maybe Hubble.
Okay.
Hubble, 25 years of beautiful pictures and great images of space and exploration of space. And I think it's pretty cool. And it was mentioned in the article, they're going to have a hard time replacing Hubble, and it's going to have to be pretty incredible to get the information that Hubble has collected over the last 25 years.
I had so much backed up here, and I'm certain I had somewhere something about Hubble also. Isn't it? Yeah, history of Hubble.
Yeah.
Like, there was in Nature, there was an article. Like, it's an anniversary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hold it. Need to find some way to get a good pause button. Is Hubble? So what is the? What's the next telescope that's being planned now? that's supposed to overlap partially.
Oh,
I
had it.
Is that the infrared one?
I'm not sure. I just had
it. Anyway, we'll talk about it next time. So, did you see my list? Is there anything that you weren't... Because we should keep it relatively short.
Okay, I have to go back to your list.
Let me see. I have Deepwater Horizon. That's like 5 years later. Planet Labs made the cover of Science, which is really cool.
Oh, I think that's worth talking about.
I don't remember much from the
Recovery of the Reefs, I would like to hear about, too.
Recovery of the Reefs, I'm trying to find. Was that in Nature?
Or? It was... Oh, you didn't put down.
Oh, yeah. It's under Nature.
Okay.
You know, I can't remember what it was.
Oh, okay.
About.
That's fine. I remember you talking to me about it earlier. And you're like, wait, I'm going to tell you about it. You know, we haven't done much with technology, and we have the Ubuntu phone.
Yeah, well, I don't have much about that either.
Okay.
I read the one article. That's probably best to... There's another article that's out that in the very latest Linux Voice,
okay,
which I haven't seen, so maybe we can hold off on that one. How about... Well, you know, the stuff that I looked at the latest... might be interesting.
Okay.
For on the education side.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Apart from that.
The setup.
We both had Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah.
Did you have?
Did not. I read about it because I knew you were going to talk about it.
Yeah.
So I read a bit about it, but I didn't get into the article. Mine was oil and gas operations.
The earthquakes.
Earthquakes causing earthquakes.
Yeah, I didn't read much about that.
That was interesting. I think it's worth...
Okay, you pick one and I'll cover what I had.
Okay, I'm back to it. Okay. What about the technique that you just read about? That's kind of this...
So the microfluidics?
Yeah.
So this was... Yeah, because of the podcast being like a lot to do with education, I started to look up Journal of Chemical Education and also Physics Teacher, which you used to get.
Yeah.
And I haven't looked at those journals in a long time, but it was amazing how many articles the latest issues had on microfluidics, done cheaply, so you could do it right in your classroom.
Right.
And one that I found that was a lot of fun, they used parafilm and either Kim wipes or Wattman paper number one.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the students would cut out channels in the parafilm. And then they would lay the parafilm over the paper and they would pass it through. It's not a laminator, but it's something that compresses with heat.
Mm-hmm.
And the parafilm would heat up and melt and soak into the paper. And so that's makes hydrophobic areas that the fluids will go through. And then they'd make several levels and stack them together. And that's how you can make Ys with channels and ports where you can enter stuff. And in certain spots, they would put reagents that change color depending on if you have iron or copper in your sample. And you have a port where you can put in your sample. So they laminate all together, and then the students could put in a sample, and the paper would act through capillary action to pull the fluid through to the two different places with reagents. And then they just used a phone to take a picture of the paper, and then some software to get exactly what the color was in the two different spots, and they made standard curves and stuff. And so that was really cool. I thought the whole idea of building something like this is in itself really a cool thing for the students to do. Definitely what they showed how to do it was just really just a proof of principle. To me, it seems like it would be a hell of a lot faster to just, you know, spot some paper and right. then spot your reagent with microliters and, mm-hmm. and just take a picture of that. So I don't think, you know, what they showed was really useful. I'd like to, you know, I'd like to know to what extent you could create such a system where the reactions you're trying to perform on your sample or the combination of reactions requires quite a complicated system, and it would actually be efficient to do it that way rather than in a different way. They definitely had some other articles that use different systems for microfluidics. I didn't look at those in depth, but that was cool. I do have one I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool. It's the L0 series train in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
That just this week broke the speed record.
That's pretty cool.
Let me see. I wrote it down. 603 kilometers per hour. It was on April 21st. 7 cars, 49 employees from the company on board. They reached the maximum speed, the world record breaking speed, 4 minutes into the run, and they kept it up for 10.8 seconds.
Wow.
During that time, traveling 1.8 kilometers. And they also set a distance record on just a few days before that, traveling over 4,000 kilometers in one day. So I thought that was really cool.
No, that is.
And they had this little blurb about how much it was costing them. So one thing that I found was interesting is the plan for the final line is going to be 85% tunnels.
Wow.
And that seems like a huge expense, but maybe it makes sense. Let's see. Okay. So, and they had a blurb, you know, with the expense being so high that they were going to try to sell the trains to other countries to help finance the line.
Right.
Which they're hoping to have completed by 2027, I think. And there was going to be a meeting just this week with Obama and one of their ministers. So I thought it was funny. It's like, we break the speed record just the day before the meeting, which so anyway,
That's neat. I thought it was neat that there are many share or stakeholders from different countries, so it wasn't just from Japan, that there's several other countries that are looking at this new technology.
Well, there's definitely several countries that are investing in high-speed trains. I don't know if anyone's looked at the L0 series seriously.
Oh, okay.
But maybe there are. I mean, I don't remember.
The other thing I wanted you to talk about is the money for toilets.
That was really cool.
I thought it was really interesting. And
yeah.
I just wanted you to explain that one.
So maybe we'll do that one and then we'll call it.
Okay.
Just it seems like you're having a pretty rough time. This was an experiment in Bangladesh, and I used to have all the stats off the top of my head because I found it so fascinating, but that was already a while ago. So I won't have any of the numbers because I didn't write them down. but basically what they did, they chose a whole bunch of villages, and they had thousands of family groups, and they had a group where they offered them education, if I remember correctly, on sanitation, a group where they had more targeted education on the benefits of having better toilet systems instead of just defecating out in the open, and I think information about where to get them.
Right.
And these cost, I don't remember, but I think it was like $30 to $40 or $50 even each. And then in a separate group, this was really interesting. They had vouchers, and the vouchers were given out at random through a lottery, and different villagers had different proportions of people that would get vouchers. So in one village, only 10% of the people would get them, I guess, and another village, 20%, and so on. And some of those also had also education on top of that, or none. And the thing that absolutely came out across the board was that education didn't do anything, whether it was specifically targeted at, you know, it's good to have toilets or just general sanitation. But there was a direct correlation between how many vouchers got out there and how many toilets were purchased.
Wow.
But what was really cool is that people whose neighbors had purchased some of these latrines were actually more likely to purchase them themselves without even having had vouchers, which kind of goes against the idea of, that, yeah, you know, if you don't do it for them, they're not going to want to buy it.
Right.
So it really says it's, education is important, because where there was education and vouchers, where there was the combination, it was higher purchase rate than just the vouchers. But really, by far, the vouchers are what did it. And what's really interesting is India's going through a big campaign to increase the sanitation. And so there's really interesting questions, because Bangladesh has a very low rate of defecation out in the open, the way I understand, but India, a very high rate.
Yeah.
Presumably because it's cultural. The experiment was done in Bangladesh, but it was done in an area where there was fairly high rates of defecation out in the open.
Right.
In India, there's possibly some cultural beliefs that people have in these villages that it's not good to have all the feces accumulating in one place.
Right.
And so they're afraid that this may or may not translate. So it's going to be very interesting to see how India's program gets ahead, because this could make a huge difference to human health.
It could.
In those countries.
Yeah. Yeah, you think of all the different diseases that are transmitted through our feces and
yeah,
waste.
Because a lot of them, it's just right into the water courses.
Right.
And when not, it's a lot of times close to water courses. So, yeah. Anyway, should we call it here? Because future plans, I guess.
Yeah.
I wrote a recent thing about getting back to doing some building for our equipment to go out in the woods and do some radio work.
Yeah.
Which will be fun. So that's going to be in the future.
And that's for ARDIF.
Yep. And there's the makerspace. We still didn't get the camera to work, but it's just because there hasn't been a makerspace.
Right. This Thursday is our next makerspace.
Yeah. So that's going to come up.
Yep.
Do we have anything else coming up right now?
We're going to be participating in a trail making project put on by a group of climbers over at Moore's Wall. So I'm really excited for that. And
I hope we can make it.
I hope we can make it. It depends on help.
But it's the Carolina Climbers Coalition, I think.
Yeah.
So that should be fun.
Yeah, and definitely want to participate and do our part.
Yeah. There's, I've been wanting to help out because they do a lot. And we get the benefits of it.
Right, we do.
And we do a lot volunteering for the school and for the orienteering, but that's one thing that we benefited without really helping out.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. And they do really good work for conservation also, I think so.
Right, definitely. Yeah.
We didn't talk at all about going rock climbing or O-meet in the rain, but I think we'll leave it.
Patrick got second in the last O-meet.
Yeah,
very
I don't think
exciting.
There's much to say to that. But
well,
yeah,
okay.
I did get
so the reason I kind of celebrated it, it's not, we're, we always try our best, but we aren't the most competitive. No. But it was just exciting to see Patrick move from a lower placement to a much higher placement suddenly. And it's after we did our work putting together a course and setting up the course. Yeah. And it's just nice to see some of our skills are coming through that we had to work on as we were putting together that course. So
yeah, it's especially interesting. I mean, I think a lot of it is a lot of the better orienteers weren't around at that meet.
Oh, yeah.
But the other thing is I actually walked for a lot of it. And I found I was catching errors a lot sooner.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, we totally have the skills, but not in a way that we can process what we see fast enough.
I know. Right? I honestly feel exactly that whenever I'm out in a meet. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I just have to slow down because I'm starting to go faster than I'm watching the map or moving across the map.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, while you're running, you don't feel that way. Like, right. You feel like you're seeing everything. And,
oh, you do. But until you miss the re-entrant.
Exactly. You're in totally the wrong place.
Right, which happened to me.
Anyway, so those are the future plans.
Mm-hmm. Very exciting.
Yep. And I think we'll just wrap it up super early because, you know, sorry to people who are listening and excited to get more of an hour, but we've had a little bit of a tough time here.
Yeah. But we'll be back on track probably the next one.
Yep.
We'll be up and running.
So thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvards podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.